This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Oh, we live in a complex world, an evolving ecosystem. Throughout human evolution, we have learned to change that ecosystem to suit our needs. But, you know, while we leave our stamp on the world is also leaving its stamp on us. And it turns out that the human body plays host to a myriad of living creatures, some good, some bad. Our relationships with these life forms are as mysterious as they are vital to our health and well-being. NC State ecologist and evolutionary biologist Rob Dunn explores these phenomena in his new book, The Wildlife of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. And Rob Dunn joins us in the studio to talk more about it. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's a real pleasure.
The thing that fascinates me about this is this book really sheds light on the fact that we are not who we are. We are colonies and filled with colonies of other species who are essential to our lives.
That's right. And I think in a number of ways. On the one hand, we have species that are living on us, that have lived on us forever. But we also have embedded in our genes the history of interactions we used to have. And so I think who we are, how we are, and how we live really are influenced by these interactions that we're mostly unaware of, even as scientists.
We're aware of interactions with other species when we get hurt. So if we have an infection, we know something's in us, we don't like it, our immune system fights it, tries to get rid of it. How is it possible then for other species, other bacteria, other parasites, to be living in us and go undetected by this immune system of ours?
Well, there's a mix. And so one really interesting body of work comes out of a guy named Bill Parker, who's at Duke University. And Parker was supposed to be working on something a few years ago called xenotransplantation, where you take an organ from one organism and put it into another. And a lot of difficulties there. But one is the human antibodies that try to kick that organ out. And so he started working on the antibodies, thinking about them. And he found an old literature about an antibody called IgA, which it turns out is the most common one in our guts. And that literature suggested that that antibody is the bacteria butt-kicking antibody. That's its primary role. But the weird thing about it was when he looked at that antibody and then at the bacteria seemed to have essentially a receptor for the antibody, as though they had a door for it. And so it really challenged what he thought, and he started to think about this. And long story short, what he came to realize and what's come to be part of the sort of main literature on the subject is that our antibodies were actually helping those bacteria. And so
I got to stop you there now, because we think of antibodies are precisely the thing that identify the other, and as you say, go out and get it, right? And now we're finding, wait a minute, it identifies it and assists?
Yeah, so I think it's better in a way to think about our immune system not as attacking the other, but as identifying good and bad, and then as a function of that information, deciding how to respond. And a big part of the way that our immune system seems to respond to what's living on our bodies is by helping a lot of it. One of the really interesting things is if you look at your sweat's full of amino acids, especially leucine. And so the question becomes, why is it there? What's it doing there? It's a costly thing. We eat food to get those amino acids. Well, nobody knows. No one's really looked at it, but it's conceivable that those same amino acids, which are part of what's feeding the bacteria on your body, are actually being produced for those bacteria. And so really, we're kind of in the dark ages of understanding what lives on us and how it influences us. And yet, even as we're ignorant, we go on living with these other species. As I wave my hands around, I know I'm on the radio, but I forget. My hands are covered with hundreds of other species.
Why aren't they just incidental? I wash my hands to get those species off so I don't get sick. That's what I think I'm doing with the other species. But you're saying some of those things are beneficial. They should be there.
That's right. So if you really scraped all of the bacteria, fungi, other things off of your body, you would get sick and you would very likely die. And that would happen in part because one of the main things those bacteria are doing is acting as a kind of first line of defense. And so when a pathogen shows up, they help to defend you against that pathogen. They're kind of a bodily garden, helping to keep the weeds out. And so they play this really important role.
So it's like mercenaries. There is probably no great – you are a tremendous authority on this. But I think the ultimate authority, of course, is the cartoon show The Simpsons. And so we're gonna go to The Simpsons now to illustrate, I think, what you're saying. And this, of course, the ancient Mr. Burns – goes to the doctor, has a battery of tests, and as far as he's concerned, he has come through swimmingly. He's very proud of himself, and here's how it goes.
You may shake my hand if you like.
Well, under the circumstances, I'd rather not.
Eh?
Mr. Burns, I'm afraid you are the sickest man in the United States. You have everything.
You mean I have pneumonia?
Yes.
Juvenile diabetes?
Yes.
Hysterical pregnancy?
A little bit, yes. You also have several diseases that have just been discovered in you.
I see. You sure you just haven't made thousands of mistakes?
No, I'm afraid not.
This sounds like bad news.
Well, you'd think so, but all of your diseases are in perfect balance.
So there might be something to that, that we actually have mercenaries fighting little wars for us.
No, and I mean, I think that clip is great. I got to stop smirking so I can talk. But it's great for a number of reasons. One is that we've been doing all this sampling of people's belly buttons and what lives in belly buttons. And it's really, on the one hand, very silly. You know, the belly button is potentially the silliest part of our body. And yet it's an interesting part of our body because it's kind of on reserve. It's a conservation area that we don't scrub quite as well. And so we now know from genetic data which species of bacteria are living in the belly buttons of all sorts of people we've sampled. And I know what was living on me, for example. And in part, it's a combination of these things that we think of as good bacteria and then all of these kinds of crazy bad things that are kind of fighting it out with the good bacteria. And I would have never known we're there except that we happened to take this sample.
Well, and you've actually discovered brand new species, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've sampled about 500 people so far, but we've done the genetics on about 90, and this is work led by Yuri Holzer and Andrea Luckey in my lab, who are both just covered in bacteria, and so from those 90 people, 90 humans, we have 1,400 species of bacteria. And this isn't like a scouring of their whole bodies and their guts and everything. This is from one Q-tip swab of their belly buttons. And there's no reason to believe we're even close to having all the bacteria you would find in their bodies. And the sense of what part of what's going on in the skin is that you have these common things, these core things that are doing good. And then you have all this other stuff that shows up. And for example, I did a sample of my forehead. One of the things that turned up that day in the sample of my forehead is a bacteria that's only known to eat pesticides. And so either I'm using the wrong kind of shampoo or I happened to have bumped into a plant that day because I also had pollen on my head. And so there's all this stuff that's bumping into you, all this stuff that's on you in a given moment. And most of that we never hear from, so to speak.
But again, getting back to these amino acids, it's not all incidental contact. Some of this stuff may have been nurtured. Our own bodies may say, look, we need something as a front line of defense in case, you know, rather than wait until we're infected. Let's feed these things. They fight the very bacteria that are enemies to us.
Yeah, and I think it's more and more clear that in our guts we are feeding these things, both by the food we eat and these antibodies, which what they're doing is to help some of these bacteria to form what are called biofilms. And biofilms are these amazing things. When they're on your teeth, you don't like them. It's what makes plaque. But it's kind of a mutualism between – it isn't kind of – it is a mutualism between many species living together in a kind of layer. And if you don't form a biofilm in the gut, what happens is you get washed out not get too visual a couple of times a day.
That's the antibiotics phenomenon. We all know that. We've taken a course of antibiotics and it ends up with a very unpleasant a very unpleasant side effect because we've wiped out some good guys who have been at war with bad guys and we don't even know it. Then the bad guys take over because we lost the good guys and we spend a little more time in the commode.
Yeah, and we imagine the antibiotics, whether we're talking about these oral antibiotics that save our lives and have saved millions of lives, or we're talking about things like antimicrobial soaps and wipes, we imagine that they're really specific, that scientists, being much smarter than anyone ever on The Simpsons, figured out these things that target the bad things, kill them, and leave us wonderful and healthy. But the truth is, I mean, most antibiotics are kind of like a giant hammer you swallow. The hammer sort of bangs around in your gut, knocks a bunch of stuff down, and if you're lucky, it knocks the bad stuff down. But it also hits all kinds of other things, and so we're really still at a very primitive stage when it comes to dealing with these species that are on us.
And on us and in our navels. And I would just say that that it's very courageous of you, Rob, to be a state employee and admit that you spend part of your time contemplating your navel.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And discovering all kinds of things.
Sad to say I'm probably not alone.
Our appendix, it turns out, is not as useless as we thought.
No. So this again, happens to be work by Bill Parker and Randall Bollinger, who's a medical doctor. And they were thinking about what's going on in our guts, and they had a lab meeting one day when they're just talking about things, and the appendix came out, or came up, not to come out. But and Bollinger had taken out thousands of appendixes during his lifetime, and they're thinking about this, and suddenly it occurs to them that the appendix is one of these parts of our gut that's just full of these IgA antibodies. It has lymphatic tissue. And they started to wonder if the appendix maybe was the storage organ for good bacteria, if its primary role was not this vestigial one, but as a kind of special garden for those cases when our guts get wiped out, when the good bacteria go away. For example, if you get cholera, which in some parts of the world is still very, very common. And so they just had this lab meeting where they could think this through. And I think one of the amazing things about this story is that here's an organ in our bodies. This isn't something in the faraway Amazon. It is something that either you have or don't have. And either way, it's kind of interesting that a bunch of folks can sit around in a lab just thinking things through and say, I wonder what it does. Well, so their idea was it was this garden that...
I tell you what, let's come back to that. We're going to take a break right now, and we'll come back to the importance of the appendix on the state of things when we talk with my guest, Rob Dunn, about the mysterious ecosystem that is our bodies. His new book, The Wildlife of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. Our conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Later on the program, the mountain goats, but first, my conversation with NC State ecologist and evolutionary biologist Rob Dunn continues. His book is called The Wildlife of Our Bodies, and we're talking about the human body and the innumerable organisms that live inside, and they make us who we are. We're talking about the appendix, long thought a vestigial organ, and then a couple of researchers wonder about that and find out, no, maybe it plays a very active part in our
lives. And the more we look at the appendix, the more we see things we should have seen before. For example, if you look at the size of our appendix relative to the appendixes of other related organisms, what you would expect if it were vestigial would be to see that we have a small appendix that's kind of atrophied over evolutionary time. And people have argued this for a long time, but nobody actually checked to see if that was the case until very recently. And when folks did check, it turns out that we have a relatively elaborate appendix that's bigger and superficially more sophisticated than our relatives and potentially our ancestors. And so it seems conceivable that our appendix not only does this important functional thing, but that it does it more now than it did in our recent past, potentially associated with some of the challenges posed to humans as we moved into denser and denser societies and ended up facing more and more infectious diseases. Because, I mean, one of the things that makes us human is ability to write books, but another is we live in great big societies and get each other sick much more than a lot of other organisms.
And we don't see it in terms of that long historical narrative. So there was a time when we all lived apart, didn't much matter. Diseases like cholera, which would wipe everything out, weren't very common. You start living together, more cholera, we need a better appendix. Now we can live it, and we're fool ourselves because we can live without it. A lot of people get them removed, nobody dies. Well, because we're a little bit better, we've wiped out cholera, essentially.
No, and so that one prediction from what Parker and Bollinger have argued is that if you have had your appendix removed and then go travel someplace where you can get cholera, that you should be affected differently than those individuals who still have an appendix. You should have a different result after getting one of those diseases. You should be probably slower to recover your gut fauna. And there are also medical examples where we could think about what might be happening. So it's not uncommon that people lose a lot of their gut fauna when they take a lot of antibiotics. What happens in those individuals that have an appendix versus those that don't? No one's ever looked at that, but it'd be really interesting.
Sounds like that's next, and that might be the next book. But let's talk about some of these other interactions, particularly how they affect brain chemistry.
So toxoplasmosis is a really interesting case in this regard. And you've probably heard about toxoplasmosis gondii in the context of pregnant women and pregnancy. And pregnant women are told, don't mess with the kitty litter. Like, get somebody else to do it. And the reason is that from cat poop, they can get toxoplasmosis, which can be very dangerous to the fetus. But the other part of this story is that there's a wild natural history of toxoplasmosis that, when we think about it, traditionally involves a rat or a mouse and a cat. And in that story, the rat or mouse is infected by toxoplasmosis. And then to reproduce, the toxoplasmosis has to get into a cat. Toxoplasmosis is kinky. It can only reproduce in cats. It doesn't matter what kind of cat, but it has to be a cat. And so you would think, well, it's a bad idea to depend on getting to a cat to reproduce. But toxoplasmosis has, quote unquote, figured this out in as much as it manipulates the brain chemistry of rats and mice. And it looks like maybe what it's doing is it's actually producing the precursors to dopamine in their brains and causes them to be more active, to be less scared, and to actually be more likely to go toward the smell of cat pee, which gets
them
eaten.
It makes mice and rats attracted to cat pee?
Yes. And so you can do a classic sort of experiment with a Y tube where you put cat pee smell on one and no cat pee on the other. And those rats and mice with toxoplasmosis go right toward that cat pee. And so it's this crazy thing that's happening out in wild nature, except that recently people have started to look at, well, what happens when humans get toxoplasmosis? And it turns out that people who show evidence of having had ever toxoplasmosis are 2.5 more times likely to get into car accidents. They're more likely to be less fearful and to do sort of more risky things. And they're much more prone to schizophrenia. There was a great study through time by Joanna Webster at Imperial College where she looked at people in the military where you had antibody reads through time. And she could show that those individuals who developed schizophrenia were much, much more likely to have, right before they developed schizophrenia, this pulse of toxoplasmosis. And so here's this crazy, crazy story. But I think there are two other pieces that are really interesting there. And so one is that toxoplasmosis is not rare. It's in about 30% of the population globally, depending on the assessment.
The human population?
Human population. Wow. And in some places like France, it's in up to 80% of people.
Well, that explains. No, go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I left that low. I'm sorry. But and one of the reasons is we can get it other ways than messing with cat poop. We get it through eating meat that's not fully cooked. Hmm. And so the story has mostly been like that. But one of the interesting things, and I talk about some of this in the book, is that it's not just rats and mice that are eaten by cats. Historically, we don't have to go very far back when large numbers of humans, hominids, and earlier primates were eaten by cats, really very recently in history, especially if you think across the last 45 million years, we spent a lot of years being about the size of a Big Mac. And so it's possible that in part this toxoplasmosis story, in addition to being a way in which our interactions influence not just how, but really who we are, our essence. I mean, what could be more essential than what we're scared of, how we drive? That this is a vestige of who we used to interact with, which I think is just fascinating.
And the fact that it then becomes the baseline, you don't even notice it anymore. It's just, as you said, it is who we are. We are now rewired and in symbiosis with creatures that would like us to act a certain way. It's in their best interest for a mouse not to be afraid of a cat.
Right. Or for a human to not be afraid of a giant tiger. And,
right.
You know, quite a few circus acts that we should check for toxoplasmosis.
So the idea that we're losing your fear goes way back to a time when we were actually worried about predators.
That's right, yeah.
And also, does it work this way in cats or is it just in mice? In other words, does it know what brain it's in and said, oh, this is the brain that I have to rewire?
So it's very unclear. It's the early days of that work, but the most recent exciting work has shown that at least in mice and rats, and no one's checked in cats as far as I know, that you do see these precursors to dopamine, and they are in specific parts of the brain. And so it looks like toxoplasmosis is pretty sophisticated.
So we might be the henchmen for some tiny little bugs that are just driving us around, doing their bidding.
Yeah, I think we really have to question exactly who we are as a function of our interactions with these other species. We think of ourselves as, you know, being in control of our lives, and we are on some level, but we're also I mean, just think about your body, Frank. You are covered with more bacterial individuals than you have your own cells. And each of those individual cells is doing something a little bit different and affecting your fate in some very real way. And we know about a teeny minority of the species that are living on you. So the idea that, you know, the pieces of the story of what's affecting us that we know now are really just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak.
Well, and let's talk about a few more examples as we contemplate that there's more on us than us walking around and behaving and pretending. I'm pretending that I'm in control of this, but who knows? But over 50% of me isn't me.
Yeah, but whoever's in control is doing a pretty good job so far, Frank.
We'll certainly get out on time. We know that. So let's talk about another example that gives us a sense of how vestigial this is, how far back it goes, the fact that some of us can drink milk and others can't.
That's right. So in the 1930s, doctors started to realize that, there are some poor individuals in the U.S. who can't drink milk as adults. It was really described as a disability, a handicap, this poor affected population. And then it had racial undertones, in as much as the individuals who couldn't drink milk were often African American or Asian American. And so it went on like that. And there were even reported deaths due to the inability to drink milk. Really it was thought of as this deficiency. And then anthropologists started to think about these questions and started to think, well, maybe there's more to it, and started to argue that perhaps what was going on was that there was this lineage of Europeans that domesticated cows, and as they did, developed evolutionarily the ability to drink milk as adults. And lo and behold, if you look at other mammals, we're the only mammal that can drink milk as an adult, as far as anyone knows. And so that then became the story, and was for a number of years, and then people started to be able to do the fancy genetics on this. And just really a couple of years ago, we're able to show that, in fact, essentially all Europeans who are able to drink milk as adults descend from this individual lineage of cow suckers who climbed under cows and benefited from it, mm-hmm. And benefited enough that their genes were passed on disproportionately. And so then that was the story. But like many of these stories, we seem to miss obvious things until we step back and get perspective. Because one of the other things that any anthropologist could have told you is that there are lots of people around the world that are not European that drink a bunch of milk, like the Dinka in Africa, who have contests to see who can drink the most milk and don't seem to suffer for it. So people began to look at those groups, and it became evident that the gene variants associated with drinking milk as adults had evolved repeatedly. That as we came to depend on cows, it was so important to who we were that we evolved, that particular groups of humans evolved these genes for drinking milk as adults. And so it's this amazing story. But one of the things it means is that you as an individual, whether or not you can drink milk as an adult, is a function not of our broad history as humans, but of your specific lineage's history of interacting with other species. And more as we look, we're seeing these differences between human lineages that result from who we used to interact with, which crops, which animals, which pathogens even. And I think it's a richness to what it is to being human.
But opening to the idea that our relationships are really defining who we are, and knowing what those relationships are, not only now but historically, would have a great deal to do with the kind of research you do. I mean, you talk about this in the book. Much of our medical research in sort of wiping disease out has kind of not paid attention to this. And so we've opened the way for other more modern diseases that we see in developed countries that we don't see in other countries.
That's right. So there's a whole suite of autoimmune diseases that's become much more common in developed countries. And they've been really very mysterious. And so one of these diseases that's becoming very common, I mean, most listeners probably know somebody with this disease, is Crohn's disease. And Crohn's disease is an autoimmune disease of the gut where the body's own immune system starts to attack the gut. And it can be incredibly debilitating. Most of the treatments for the disease are very unpleasant and can be debilitating in their own right. And so if you look through time in North America or Northern Europe, you see that this disease has become much more common even over the last 50 years. And so one of the interesting things that's happened during that time period is we've mostly gotten rid of our worms. And so we've changed the species that live with us. historically, most of us, and by historically, I mean from 100 years ago to 300 million years ago, most of the individuals in our lineage would have had worms, and often many species of worms. And then as we started to do new things in developed countries, like no longer pooping on our feet or walking through other people's poop, those worms became more and more rare. And most of us in the U.S., for example, don't have any of those worms. And so it started to be argued that perhaps those two things are connected. And so there's a growing body of work essentially arguing that these autoimmune disorders have become common as a function of removing worms from our guts. And what's happening is that our immune system is essentially overreacting to the absence of the worms.
Mm. Well, and is it also, to put that another way, in order for something other like this worm to survive, it needed to somehow sedate, if I can use that term, sedate the immune system, calm it down so it didn't wipe it out. Well, a calmer immune system means it won't attack itself either. Worm's gone, that sedative effect is gone, and the immune system goes into overdrive.
Yeah, I think that's right, or at least it's a piece of what might be going on. So I like to think of it like gravity, that plants evolved with gravity. Gravity's not good for plants. It makes life harder. I mean, NC State's sending some plants up on this launch this week. But if you grow plants in the absence of gravity or with little gravity, they waste lots of energy. They grow crooked. And they don't do it because gravity was good, but they do it because they evolved with gravity as a predictable presence. And I think what's going on with worms is something like that. And that sounds really metaphorical, but the truth is we're still really ignorant about what's going on. And so I think in part it's that the worms may have been producing things that calm the immune system, and partially that the immune system sort of reacted enough as would have needed to be necessary given the presence of those worms.
Now that they're gone, it's just reacting against itself in a sense. All of this really raises the question about how we approach research and think about what it means to be modern, what it means to improve our life. I mean, for instance, antibacterial soap. We think bacteria is bad, and we know that it really has increased our lifespan just by cleaning our food and cleaning our hands. It's been very important. So why not antibacterial soap? It sort of makes sense in that lineage. But as you look at the big picture, then you begin to wonder.
No, I think that's right. And just sort of two pieces before that related to that. One is that I think the medical approach is to fix the car when it's broken. And it's not relational. It doesn't give us the big perspective either across space or across time. And the other is that the people who are good at studying these relational things, evolutionary biologists and ecologists, they tend to go to far-off wonderful places where, you know, all kinds of rare new bird species are up in the rainforest canopy, which is great, but they don't want to spend time in the colon. I mean, if you can study a macaw, the colon seems unglamorous.
Yeah.
But the truth is we're still part of this story. I mean, the most urban life you could conceivably live is still one in the context of these species. And so that's where these antibiotic wipes come in, I think, is that we have this idea to get rid of all these species. We fix the car because we're getting sick. But the truth is we tend not to be very critical of something like antibiotic wipes when it fits within our view that we need to be cleaner. And so it turns out there's very little evidence that those wipes and antibiotic soaps make us healthier. In fact, they don't do any better than soaps at preventing the diseases people typically worry about. In addition, they do bad things too. And so I think this broader perspective with history and evolution and ecology in it really changes how we think about a lot of these things, and it's really important.
It changes the way we think. Is it something, as you thread out the picture, now as we're beginning to see us in relationship to other species and not simply the individual, can we ever get our head around that? Are the relationships too complex for us to really grasp?
I think that's an interesting question. I think that we will be able to get our heads around pieces of these stories, individual interactions that we can better understand. But I think that the broader sense that we're part of this diverse web of interactions that influence who and how we are all the time, that's really hard to get an intuitive sense of. It's hard to escape that sensibility that, well, I am who I am, that sort of Popeye view of the world. And I think really we are who we are, but also who the species we've interacted with are, who the species our ancestors interacted with are. And I mean, I've written about it and read about it a great deal, and I still forget about it in my daily interactions all the time.
I'm actually going to leave you a minute for this, but I want to put the question another way, and whether or not we can do this analytically. Does examining the pieces ever add up to this, or do we have to come at the study of who we are in a whole different way to get that bigger picture?
I think we do have to come at it in a whole different way. I think we have to come at it from the perspective that we are still wild animals living in wild ecosystems. They're ecosystems we put our thumb down really hard on, but they're still ecosystems in which wild species are living on us, interacting with us every day. I don't like this distinction between that, you know, nature is something being far away. There's a kind of nature that's far away, but you are nature, I'm nature, we're covered in nature, and we could ignore that nature, but it goes on. We have forehead mites on our head, and you know, it's a silly example, and yet they are reproducing, they are dying as we talk, and no one on Earth studies them, not a single person from an ecological or evolutionary perspective. And so I think we need that. We need to think of ourselves as wild organisms and understand who we are in that light.
Belly button ecologist and evolutionary biologist Rob Dunn. Thank you. Have you ever been called that before?
No, I've not. But
well, we've reached a new milestone on the program. Rob Dunn's new book, he's the author of Every Living Thing. His latest book is The Wildlife of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. Rob is really an ecologist and evolutionary biologist at NC State University. Just ahead on The State of Things, the music of the mountain goat. Stay with us.